Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 68, Text Number 11, 12, and 13. I'll chant 11 and 12, and we'll chant 13 responsively. Tvam tu te viratam chakrus chatvaras chat chaturahayam ekas tu sharatim jagne chichiddanam sarashanam. Excuse me. Translation. But they forced him down from his chariot, and thereupon four of them struck his four horses. One of them struck down his chariot driver, and another broke his bow. Text 12. Tam badvarita kritya krityena kuravaryudi kumaram svasya kanyam cha svapunam jahino vishvan. Having deprived Samba of his chariot during the fight, the Kuru warriors tied him up with great difficulty and then returned victorious to their city, taking the young boy and their princess. Text number 13, responsively. Come on. Sambadvare rati kritya. That's 13, right? No, I'm sorry. There we go. Shatrutvu naradaktena. Rajan sanjata manyava. Kurun pratyud yaman chakrur ugrasena prachodita tachchutva naradok naradoktena rajan sanjata manyava Kurun pratyudya yudyaman chakrur ugrasena prachodita tachchutva naradoktena rajan sanjata manvaya kurun pratyudyaman chakrur Ugrasena prachodita. Please chant. Ladies. This, Shutva, hearing, Narada, of Narada Muni, Uktena, through the statements, Rajan, O King Parikit, Sanjata, awakened, Manyava. Whose anger? Kurun. The Kurus. Prati. Against. Udyamam. Preparations for war. Chakru. They made. Ugrasena. By King Ugrasena. Prachodita. Urged on. Translation. O King, when the Yadavas heard news of this from Narada Muni, they became angry. Urged on by King Ugrasena, they prepared for war against the Kurus. Please repeat. O King, when the Yadavas heard news of this from Sri Narada, they became angry. Urged on by King Ugrasena, they prepared for war against the Kurus. Purport. Actually, if you look at this purport, you could actually say purport by Srila Prabhupada, because the entire purport is Prabhupada's quote. Srila Prabhupada writes, the great sage Narada immediately carried the news to the Yadu dynasty. The Sambha was arrested and told them the whole story. The members of the Yadu dynasty became very angry at Sambha's being arrested, and improperly so, by six warriors. Now, with the permission of the head of the Yadu dynasty's king, Ugrasena, they prepared to attack the capital city of the Kuru dynasty. Om Gyanatam Randasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chaksu Unmilitam Minatasmai Sri Guru Namaha Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangum Lamjayate Girim Yakripatam Aham Bande Sri Gurum Dinatarinam Idam Pratamaya Deva Grihita Purata Tava Nivigdham Siddham Ayato Prasadatte Keshava Grihitoshmin Vrata Deva Panchitam Yari Bhavavet Tadabhavatu Sampuna Prasadat Te Janardana Govardhandaram Vande Gopalam Goparupinam Goloku Shav Golok Latshavam Ishanam Govindam Gopika Priyam Vanshakalpatu Rubis Chakripa Sindhavahebacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasidhi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. So listen to these last few classes that we've been having on this particular subject. I kind of feel a bit unqualified, more than a bit. But when you're asked to do service by the Vaishnavas, you can only pray for the mercy of the Vaishnavas to complete that service and be successful in doing so. So with your blessings. Chanaka Pandit states in the 9th chapter, 11th verse of his Niti Shastra, that a wise man spends their morning in discussing gambling, their afternoon in discussing the activities of women, and their evening in hearing the activities of thievery. Interesting. He then gives an explanation. The first item, of course, refers to the gambling activities of King Yudhishthir, the devotee of the Lord in the Mahabharata. The second item refers to the glorious deeds of Mother Sita, the consort of Lord Ramchandra, as told in the Ramayana. And the third item refers to the adorable childhood pastimes of Sri Krishna as he steals butter, among other things, from the elderly cowherd ladies of Gokula, as mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So thus, Chanaka Pandit advises us that we should spend our mornings absorbed in the Mahabharata, our afternoons in the Ramayana, and our evenings in devoted hearing of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This gives an explanation as to why we're sitting here listening to the activities of what, in reality, is a family squabble over the marriage of two offspring from the two different families. It really, I mean, while it seems like it's a subject that is of little concern to those of lofty inquiry, as Srila Prabhupada says, if you simply put Krishna in the middle of anything, then it becomes beneficial. So because these are these personalities we're discussing, they're dear relatives, friends, and devotees of the Lord, the discussion of these activities actually frees us from the ropes and the bondage of birth and death. Regarding Sambha, Nagaraj Prabhu spoke very nicely some background on Sambha last week. I'd like to add a couple of things to here as I was taking a look at this. If we examine just, you know, From an observation point of view, if we examine the traits of Thamba, we find that the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, as well as others, give the following qualities. Very handsome and pretty. He's a very bad boy. He's prone to mischief and troublemaking. This is right in this chapter. And he's what we would refer to nowadays as a mama's boy. He's always by his mother's side. And because of number one and number three, being very handsome and pretty and being a mama's boy, he's able to get away with pretty much anything he wants to. And this is in no small part due to the fact that his mother, Jambavati, is openly stated as Krishna's favorite queen. Matter of fact, Jiva Goswami says that Sambha and his nine brothers are the most favored sons of Krishna. So, you know, he's a little coddled, one might say. Actually, in the Nectar Devotion, how much he's favored is noted by Prajumna. Prajumna says to him, he says, "My dear Sambha, you are such a glorified personality. I have seen that even while you're playing on the ground and covered in dirt, our father Krishna takes you on his lap and embraces you. I am so unfortunate. I can never get such love from our father." So in this way, there's several different types of indications as to the special accommodations, one might say, that Sambha gets. So, you know, these qualities mean that because he's a bit pampered, and because his mother shelters him, because this, he's able to get away with so many things, and he becomes a little bit bold in some of his, what he might interpret as prankish activities. In this chapter, it's described here that not only did he desire to have the hand of Lakshman in marriage, but he decided that I'll get it no matter what it takes. Matter of fact, I'll just take the hand of somebody, of Lakshman in marriage. So, to be fair, this type of behavior is not unheard of in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. The arrangement between Krishna and Rukmini was not to the liking of Rukmini's parents. She arranged an elopement, you might say, through sending the notes and all to Krishna. There are many examples of this happening. It's noted that there are eight different types of marriage in Vedic society. And I thought it might be a little interesting to take a look at the explanation of some of these and examine how Sambha's arranged efforts for marrying Lakshmana fit into these. Now, of course, not all eight types of marriage are sanctioned by religious principles. They exist, but they're not all. The first four that we'll mention are considered proper and accepted by society at large. The second two are considered acceptable to the Kshatriyas, and the seventh is considered acceptable by the Vaishyas and the Sudras. And the eighth one, well, we'll find out about that when we get to it. So the first type of marriage given is the Brahma marriage. And in the Brahma marriage, the marriage of the daughter, after she's properly adorned and dressed and everything, with costly garments and there's presents of jewels, she's given to a man of good conduct who's learned in the Vedas and is invited by the father to please take the hand of his daughter in marriage. Then we have the Adaiva marriage. And this is one in which, here again, the daughter is appropriately dressed and decorated with ornaments. And then as a result of all, in the course of all this, she's given to the priest of a particular religious ceremony to accept as his wife. And then we have what's called the Arshya marriage. And this is when the father gives the daughter away to a bridegroom after receiving some sort of payment. Traditionally, this would be a cow or a pair of bulls. I don't know if one over the other was more accepted, but. And then we have the Prajapatya marriage. And this is when the father is very, very satisfied with the arrangement. He gives the bridegroom and the bride together with his full blessings, that may both of you be happy and perform your religious ceremonies together. So this is with the complete blessings of the father. And then, of course, we have the Gandharva marriage. And the Gandharva marriage is the voluntary union of a boy and a girl that springs from a common desire for joining together in marriage. And then the Asura marriage, and this is when the groom receives the girl after having given of his own free will whatever wealth or whatever facility, fortune he can to the father, to the bride, and to her relatives. But the caveat here is that he's from a lower caste. So you might say he's kind of buying his way into the marriage. And then, of course, we have the Rakshasa marriage, which we're seeing here in this chapter, where the maiden is stolen from her relatives. Sometimes there is a battle in which the relatives are left either slain or wounded. And sometimes the girl's going is voluntary and sometimes it's not. Of course, now, in the Svayambhara ceremony that we're seeing here in this chapter, one of the qualifications is that the groom proves himself. So although it indicates in this chapter that Lakshmana was not so inclined to Sambha, seeing him prove himself in this way kind of, you know, made her consider it. Now, then there's the last type, which is mentioned here, and it's the Paisascha marriage. And this is when a man seduces a girl while she's sleeping, intoxicated, or she's mentally challenged. And this is condemned by Manusmriti and not accepted by society and not approved of. So these are the eight types of marriages that are executed in Vedic society. Now, we hear this list and we kind of think, I mean, I'm sure all of us, wow, these are a little out of date. But actually not so much so. There's some modern places in the world where this still takes place. I have knowledge of one Vaishnava family in Russia where both the mother and daughter were kidnapped, Rakshasa style, from the family for marriage. And the mother's marriage is a very long-standing, very happy and satisfying marriage. And the daughter's marriage appears to be on the same road. But the young boy wanted to marry the girl, kidnapped her away from the parents, took her home to his village where the family members all, you know, were very happy to have her. And then, this actually went on with two sisters. So, you know, sometimes these things still go on. This is the different types of marriage that we come across, one of which, of course, is being described in this chapter here. Moving on from the marriage side of this, going back to Sambha, this is not the only time that we find Sambha causes a little bit of trouble. From as best I can sort out the timeline, after the kidnapping, and then sometime later after the Battle of Kurukshetra, 35 years later is when Sambha and the other princes, the young Kaurava princes, this is Srimad Bhagavatam describes them, who have developed a diminished respect for elders and proper behavior, decide to pull their infamous trick on the sages. I thought about this. Let's take a look at this group of sages. Srimad Bhagavatam tells us some of the various members of this group. Narada Muni, Durvasa Muni, Vashishta Muni, Vishwamrita Muni, Bhrigu Muni, Angira Muni, and several others. Now, that particular list of names, this is not a group of sages to be trifled with. These are not, a couple of them are known for having fiery tempers and being pretty intolerant. So common sense would say, oh, let's don't go playing tricks on this group. Of course, as they say, common sense is not always so common. So, which reminds me of one of my favorite letters from Srila Prabhupada. This was early on, one devotee was writing, and the letter has 1,294 questions. You know, Prabhupada, what about this? Prabhupada, what about this? And Prabhupada's writing back these, you know, very short and to-the-point answers. And at the conclusion, Prabhupada says, in conclusion, when trying to sort these things out, just use your common sense. And if you don't have any, find someone that does. So, at any rate, Sridhar Swami explains in the Bhagavatam he's quoted as, these sages, this group of sages, had come to Dwarka, to Vasudeva's house, to perform different types of religious juggas, different types of ceremonies, for the benefit of halting the sinful advancement, the reactions of sinful advancement of Kali Yuga. So they were, you know, performing all these different activities. At the conclusion, they were given their gifts to Dakshin, and then Krishna invited them. You can go to this place nearby. What's the name of that? Pindaraka. And take your rest. And just a little side note here. The Dakshin is awarded to the priest at the conclusion of the ceremony that they've been asked to perform, not some days later, some weeks later, after the ceremony's been done. The purpose for this is quite simple, that the culmination of the benefits of that said jugga, whatever type it is, are sealed by the dakshin given to the priest. So if the dakshin given to the priest doesn't take place for a month, a year, 6 months, whatever, then you may be experiencing delayed results. At any rate, so after all of this is done, Krishna invites him to this holy place. It's about 2 miles from Dwarka, just off the coast of Gujarat. And it's a very peaceful and very nice place. So while they're there, this is when Samba and his friends, I guess the word nowadays would be his entourage, they decide, hey, let's go play a joke on the sages. So they pad Samba's stomach. We all know the story. And Srimad Bhagavatam 11th canto picks up from there. To that holy place, the young boys of the Yadu dynasty had brought Samba, the son of Jambavati, dressed in women's garb. Playfully approaching the great sages gathered there, the boys grabbed hold of the sages' feet and impudently, with feigned humility, said, oh, learned brahmanas, this black-eyed pregnant woman has something to ask of you. But she's too shy to ask herself. She just wants to inquire when she gives birth, and will it be very desirous if she gets a son? So in this way, all the sages, it mentions, and then they concluded, since you are all great sages with infallible vision, please tell us whether she will have a boy or a girl. So they think this is quite fun. You know, you can just see a group of, you know, young men, let's assume teenagers, whatever, maybe late teens, and they're just thinking this is just, oh, jolly good time. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur makes a comment in the purport in the 11th canto. The impudent behavior of the young Yadus towards the sages headed by Narada, who were all brahmanas and devotees of the Lord, is the beginning of the display of deviation from the path of Lord Krishna. Bhagavatam continues. Thus ridiculed by deceit, the sages became angry and told the boys, you fools, she will bear an iron club that will destroy your entire dynasty. Upon hearing the curse of the sages, the terrified boys quickly uncovered the belly of Samba and saw indeed that there was an iron club there. Upon hearing the words of the Vaishnavas headed by Narada, the Yadu boys lifted the garment covering Samba's abdomen and saw the fruit of the offense they had committed against the Vaishnavas by their deceit. Very strong words. The fruit of the offense committed against the Vaishnavas by their deceit. An actual club was there, meant to destroy their dynasty. Of course, there wasn't a club there in the first place. This is the potency of Narada. Bhagavatam continues. The Yadu boys, the luster of their faces completely faded, brought the club to the royal dynasty, and in the presence of the Yadavas, they told King Ugrasena what had happened. You can just imagine, you know, they thought they're going to have great fun, they get this curse, now they've got to go in front of Ugrasena. Now, of course, King Ugrasena is not just sitting by himself, he's got his entourage, his followers, his associates, his administrators. So now they've got to come before them to hang their heads and tell what they've done, because they know they've really pulled a big one here. This club and their curse is going to kill everybody, so very embarrassing for them. So they go in, they tell the whole story. Of course, then we know everything gets ground up, thrown in, it grows into weeds, one little piece is left, the fish eats it, Jara the hunter gets it, and the story goes on. So Mahabharata, though, mentions that after this curse, several different types of bad omens befall the city of Dwarka. Now, first of all, after this happens, King Ugrasena issues an order. He says there will be no production, distribution, or consumption of intoxicated spirits. So, you know, it was pretty common for Kshatriyas to, partake of libation. So he says, not going to happen. Not making it, not distributing it, not taking it here. So after this, some of the different bad omens that come upon Dwarka, pests begin to multiply. Sinful activities begin to multiply. Yet, nobody feels any shame in having done those sinful activities. Wives deceive their husbands. Husbands deceive their wives. Everyone has terrifying dreams. People insult and humiliate their seniors and their teachers. So Krishna sees all of this and he says, you know, we have to go on pilgrimage to the sacred waters of the Prabhas Sea and do some tapasya. So they get there, and of course, when they get there, the Yadava warriors kind of take it as it's a vacation. And they take up, you know, they've been on prohibition in Dwarka, and prohibition's been lifted, and so they take up to drinking this particular type of beverage made there. So Bhagavatam 11 Canto picks up the story again. Infuriated, they seize their bows and arrows, swords, balas, clubs, lances, and spears, and attacked one another on the shore of the ocean. Riding on elephants, chariots with flags, flying, and also on donkeys, camels, bulls, buffaloes, mules, and even human beings, the extremely enraged warriors came together and violently attacked one another with arrows, just as elephants in the forest attack one another with their tusks. You can just see one of these warriors on the back of another warrior. That one particularly made me laugh. Even on human donkeys, okay, you know, you see them riding on a donkey or camels, bulls, but mules, but on the backs of each other, you know? Their mutual enmity aroused, Prajumna fought fiercely with Samba. And remember, Prajumna, I mean, way under, because this is all Leela, but Nectar Devotion showed there had been a little hint of envy between Prajumna and Samba anyway. So when this all starts, Prajumna attacks Samba. Akura fights with Kunti Bhoja. Aniruddha attacks Satyaki. Subhadra fights with Sangramajit. Sumitra fights with Sarata. And the two Gaudavas fight with each other. Also, warriors such as Nishasta, Ulmuka, Sahasrajit, Satrajit, and Banu all confronted and killed each other, blinded by two things here. This is important to note. Blinded by the intoxication and bewildered by Lord Mukunda himself. This is the key point in this particular part here. This is all the plan of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to rid the earth as he's beginning to wind up his pastimes. Bhagavatam continues. Completely abandoning their natural friendship, the members of the various Yadu clans, the Dasharas, the Vrishnis, the Andakas, the Bhojas, the Satpatas, the Madhus, the Arbudas, the Maturas, the Surasenas, the Kururas, the Kuntis, they all slaughtered one another. Thus bewildered, sons fought with fathers, brothers with brothers, nephews with paternal and maternal uncles, grandsons with grandfathers, friends fought friends, well-wishers fought well-wishers. In this way, intimate friends and relatives all killed one another. When all their bows had been broken, their arrows and other missiles had been spent, they seized the tall stalks of cane that were growing on the bank with their bare hands. As soon as they took these cane stalks into their fists, the cane stalks changed into iron rods as hard as thunderbolts, and they began to beat each other with them, attacking each other again and again. When Lord Krishna tried to stop them, they attacked him as well. In their confused state, they mistook Lord Balaram as their enemy. Weapons in hand, they ran toward him with the intention of killing him. You can just see how completely inebriated they've become. O son of the Kurus, Krishna and Balaram then became very angry. Picking up cane stalks in their own hands, which also turned to iron rods, they moved about the battle and began to kill their opponents. The violent anger of these warriors, who had overcome by the Brahmana's curse and bewildered by Lord Krishna's illusory potency, here again, both things, not one or the other, but both things, now led them to annihilation, just as a fire that starts a bamboo grove destroys the entire forest. When all the members of his own dynasty were thus destroyed, Lord Krishna thought to himself that at last the burden of the earth had now been removed. And then, of course, this sets the stage for his own departure, Balaram's departure, and like that. So we see the result of the long-term prankster, frivolous nature of Sambha. Of course, as we mentioned, twice it mentions in the Bhagavatam directly, this is all the Lord's plan, all his arrangement for this to happen. But the instrument is Sambha with his playing jokes on these sages. Now, of course, this is after the kidnapping mentioned in this chapter, and after the battle of Kurukshetra, and he's still playing pranks. This means that, as I was discussing with someone, that, you know, if you're a prankster, your tendency is just to never give it up, even when you're old enough to know better, you know. So, but this type of prank, it was totally undeserved, and it was base humor inflicted upon these great sages. It's interesting to note, just for the, by the way, that you can look at this later in the day, in the 11th canto, chapter 1, verses 11 to 16, Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati each give very, very insightful explanations as to this whole pastime and how it impacts the degradation of Kali Yuga, especially since the time of Mahaprabhu. It's really, really worth a good read. So, back to our current story with Sambha. I noted that there were a couple of very well-known personalities involved in this pastime. Both Uddhava and Grandfather Bhishma have prominent roles in this. After King Ugrasena decides to send the warriors to rescue Sambha, he sends Lord Balaram as his emissary, and Balaram particularly takes Uddhava with him, because Uddhava is, you know, he's known for being very equipoised and being able to mediate things. I was thinking that Uddhava could probably be the worshipable deity of the Ombudsman program for ISKCON, and I've intentionally mispronounced that. I know how it's pronounced, but Ombudsman works better. So they should all have a deity of Uddhava they can worship. At any rate. So we see that Uddhava was very successful. You know, he was very successful in laying them, because Balaram was very well liked by the Kurus. I mean, he was the teacher of Duryodhana, and, very favorable to the family like that. So when they heard Balaram's here, oh, great, let's go get him. They got all the worshipable paraphernalia, and in honorable style, they left their residence to go and greet him. Okay, we'll tell him to come in. We'll receive him. That's one way of receiving an honored guest. Okay, yeah, come over here. Have a seat. Yeah. The other way is to go and receive that person. This is more respectful. And not only go and receive that person, but take honorable items. You can count on the fact there would have been Madhuparka, there would have been Chamar, there would have been Chandan on the forehead, all these different things, you know. So in this way, they go, and they're very, very happy to see Balaram. So why have you come? And then he tells them, because you're all nonsense, and we want Sambha back. And matter of fact, his bride also. Well, that does it. They don't want to hear anything at that point. The arrogance of their pride then takes over. And it's this lack of humility in their dealings that it becomes their undoing. And actually, if you look at it, it's the lack of humility in any of our dealings that becomes our undoing. This is why one of the single most important instructions from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Trinada Pisanishena, Tarora Pisahishnuna, Amani Namana Dena, Kirtaniya Siddhahari. This is, many devotees, they have this, some devotees even have it tattooed on their neck. Many devotees have it carved into tulsi and worn around their neck like that. I mean, this is a very important prayer, because it imbibes the mood we should have in our heart as we're executing our devotional service, as we're dealing with our fellow devotees. We see that mood is completely absent here in this exchange. Balaram is coming good faith. You know, he didn't have to come. He could have said, just, yeah, go get him. Give it to him. No, let's not have a war here. We're all family. Let me go mediate this. Uddhava, go and speak to them. Uddhava convinces them. They come out. But the minute Balaram tells it like it is, their pride and arrogance and lack of humility becomes completely prominent and overtakes the entire situation. And ultimately, as we see, becomes their undoing. So this humility, if it's not in one's mind, heart, and dealings, we can be assured that obstacles will lie ahead of us in the path of devotional service. I do find it interesting that Balaram, in both two scenarios, this scenario here and in the Battle of Kurukshetra, chose to avoid the battle if it could be avoided. And when it couldn't be avoided, he, in the Battle of Kurukshetra, he just, all right, I'm not going to be there. I'm going on pilgrimage. So, you know, this was due to his loving feelings for both sides. It was too difficult for him to take one side over the other. So, now the other person I was mentioning was Grandfather Bhishma Dev. And this is another example where our devoted and honorable Grandfather Bhishma Dev is just on the wrong side of the equation. You know, not only does he say to the warriors, yes, Sambha kidnapped Lakshman, go and get him. Matter of fact, I'll go with you. Let's go get him. You know, I mean, he has a role to play in Krishna's pastimes to bring these things about. And ultimately, of course, he's one of our great Mahajans. But he, at least in that scenario, there does have the presence of mind to instruct the warriors, but do not harm him. He must not be killed. Capture him and bring him back, but don't take it too far. So, you know, this shows that the warriors were actually very serious about attacking Sambha. You know, they were like, okay, he's stolen our daughter, so he's going to get it. That's going to be it for him. This is another one of those conundrums of Bhishma Dev, where he's a very morally right person, but seems to make the wrong decision. So, as I say, we can only chalk this up to his divine lila with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is a third person I noted in this pastime, and let us not forget our favorite and most divine instigator, Sri Narada Muni himself. If there's a plot being stirred up, if there's an effort to push the pastimes of the Lord forward, Narada Muni's probably behind it. I mean, if you went to the Bhagavatam and picked out all the different times Narada has sparked things, it's probably be quite a list. Whether it's through his personal instructions to someone, or through an unembodied voice, or through being the driving force to push people into whatever it takes to bring about the action that will cause the Lord's appearance, he's very, very enthusiastic to see these divine pastimes take place. Very, very enthusiastic for them. And, you know, we understand here again that he's the instrument of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and acting these things on his behalf. And this is one of the ways in which he serves the Lord, to instigate, move forward, to promote the different activities and pastimes while the Lord is on this planet. So, and he does this first class, goes right to the Yadus and tells them, you know, not only does he tell them Sambha got kidnapped, but he gives the whole story. And you can imagine it wasn't just a passive, well, you know, well, he took me and then, you know, so he kidnapped, so you might want to go get him. You know, Narada's trying to get things rolling here, so I'm sure it was a very lively storytelling of what was actually going on. And then what does he do? He sits back to watch the fun take place. Narada does this repeatedly. He doesn't get involved in the fray once it happens. He just sits back and watches the pastimes of the Lord manifest. So, one other thing I came across here that I thought also noteworthy is the mention in these verses of this part of the Bhagavatam, this chapter, about the fairness that was expected but not present in the capture of Sambha by the opposing warriors. I mean, even if you got a street fight, 6-1 odds, that's really not seen as very fair. What to speak of Kshatriyas who have certain rules governing them in battle, certain types of etiquette they're supposed to follow. So I did a quick little research here and came up with some of the qualities that a Kshatriya should have to protect the citizens from harm, especially women, children, cows, brahmanas, and the elderly. To ensure that the citizens perform their prescribed duties and advance spiritually. To be the first into a battle and never flee from the battlefield till it is completed. To be true to their royal word. To never refuse a challenge. to develop noble qualities such as power, chivalry, generosity, to levy taxes but only from the vicious, and never to accept charity in any circumstance, to take counsel from the brahmanas, to know shastras, especially the Arthashastra, to deal uncompromisingly with crime and lawlessness, to take responsibilities for shortcomings in their own kingdom, to conquer their own minds and senses, and to enjoy only according to scriptural injunction, and of course, to beget an heir. Now, they have certain rules governing them in battle, too. They're not allowed to put poison on the tip of their arrows. It's got to be a clean arrow, no poison arrow. They're not allowed to attack those that are sick or old. They're not allowed to attack children or women. And they're not allowed to attack a warrior from behind. Now, if you've got six people attacking Sumba, certainly some of them were behind him. I mean, you get a circle going around him. Another thing, Manasamitra says that when you're fighting another warrior, if his top knot becomes loose, you have to stop long enough for him to tie his hair back up. I don't know. Apparently, it's very important for them to have their hair tied up. another thing about warriors, I found in Agni Purana, there are 9 asanas given to warriors to take up, 9 different types of asanas in the battle. It describes all 9 of them. I won't go into them. You know, how to stand, how to put this foot there, and, you know, stand, all these different stances like that. So, and then there are 3 additional guidelines given to kshatriyas, that a warrior in armor, a kshatriya that's in armor on the battlefield, cannot fight with another warrior that does not have armor. So this means that if, as in some of the descriptions in Mahabharata, they shoot the armor off that warrior, well, okay, now I got to take mine off, I'm going to continue fighting with you. Second thing is that they should only fight one enemy and cease fighting once that opponent is disabled. Well, clearly we see that didn't happen here with Sumba. There were 6 of them on him. And that aged men, women, and children, the retreating, or one who has straw in their lips as a sign of unconditional surrender, must not be killed. So we can see the attack by these 6 highly qualified warriors on Sumba is, by every means of a Kshatriya code, irreligious transgression of their battle etiquette. At any rate, these were just some of the thoughts and ideas that I felt reflected on this particular set of verses here. These are, as I say, because these are the pastimes of the Lord and his devotees, they're worthy of us delving into them and becoming familiar with them. Otherwise, the daily papers, the news, the internet, those rag sheets that you're forced to look at the checkout column, they're filled with all this kind of stuff. But it's of no relevance to us because it has nothing to do with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is what we do as devotees. We try to absorb ourselves in speaking about the Lord. We try to absorb ourselves in remembering the Lord. And we share that conversation, that discussion with each other, and that's the whole function of our Srimad Bhagavatam class, everyone. So we'll finish there. I've run a bit over time. My apologies. If there's any quick questions, we have about 3 or 4 minutes. Actually, I'm way over, but anyway. Mukunda, something short?
Just a quick note. Baladev's traveling and doing Tirtha Yatra during the Battle of Kuruksetra. Yeah, the Acharyas have said it would not be possible, due to his great love and affection for Krishna, for him to give up the desire to be with him at such a crucial time because of Duryodhan. So that was a pretense in order for him both to empower the holy places and also to go to Namasaranya to make sure that the actual Bhagavatam, which was intended for our benefit, would get spoken. Because what Romaharsan Sutta had was what was given prior to Vyasadeva speaking to Narada Muni. So when Vyasadeva, in his maturity, realized Bhagavatam, that should be given. So by killing Romaharsan Sutta, it allowed Sutta Goswami to be empowered that when he went to the last days of Maharaj Parikshit, he heard from Shukadeva Goswami. Then it says, Ekada, one day he came back to Namasharanya, then he spoke real Bhagavatam. So this was the purpose of Baladev not fighting.
This is the amazing thing of the Personality of Godhead. He can complete so many different things just by doing one activity. Various different goals will get achieved, you know? I mean, it looks like, all right, he just doesn't want to see everybody, but actually there's a whole range of things that are going to be accomplished by that. Shri Vikram Prabhu?
Okay. The Lord used the course by the sages to annihilate the Yadu dynasty, because to wrap up his past and he had to like eradicate them also, and that was the last one. So he used that course to do that, because he knows that all these weeds would turn into iron mace and so forth, you see. And that was a good one, because the Yadus, they were like demigods, and they had to go back to their different...
Right. Well, it describes in the 11th canto, in the verses regarding this subject, that, you know, Krishna realized the earth is still overburdened. Battle of Kurukshetra is gone, all those people are gone, but what about all my kinsmen? They're overburdening the earth. So how to get rid of them? Well, they can't be killed by anybody else. They have to fight each other. So that, here again, the plot of the Lord, by doing one thing, so many different things can take place. Yeah. So ultimately, as much as we might look at Sambha and go, what a rascal. He was integral in the pastimes of the Lord. So what a wonderful devotee. If we can just be as good as Sambha. All right, we'll finish there. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.